From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I miss him. And it was the worst time of my life, not because I'd had a heart attack, but because here was a guy who wrote every story about some, you know, crazy in a colorful costume saving somebody at the last minute, and nobody could save him.
Now it can be told how filmmaker and geek Kevin Smith set out to rescue his hero, the legendary Stan Lee. Last year, Smith began to fear that the elderly co-creator of Spider-Man, Iron Man, and the X-Men was being abused. Smith acted, though he felt strongly that there could be no good outcome. This week, we bring you part two of our interview with Kevin Smith. He tells us about his friendship with Lee and explains why he called me to share his concern about what was happening to Lee following the death of his beloved wife, Joan. What did I do? I pulled in my colleague, Gary Baum, who went on to write an award-winning exposé. Baum also joins us to talk about that. For Kevin Smith, as you'll hear, the whole story was absolutely heartbreaking. But first, we banter. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Joker is poised. We don't know the numbers, but clearly Joker is going to open very big. However, this is a controversial film. It is a film that I think there was hesitation about making at Warner Brothers. Hard R, dark, dark, dark. You've seen it. I haven't. I feel kind of squeamish about it.
Yeah, I've seen it, and it's really, really dark. It's violent. It is disturbing. It is nihilistic. It's also really well done, but it also raises a lot of issues. It is firmly set in a gritty, realistic world where gun violence and populist uprising, it has parallels to the current environment in a way that makes the violence all that much more disturbing.
Yeah, this started when the public hadn't seen the movie, the general public. There was so much, you know, concern that I think the military advised its members to be cautious about going to screenings. It could almost be a self-fulfilling prophecy that if somebody's looking to make trouble and they're hearing about this violent movie, it could be like a combination of, you know, they feel inspired, the attention you would get. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't want to complete the sentence. But, you know, it is a film. And we've seen this kind of thing before, you know, that where a movie has come into a particular setting with a particular theme, and there's just incredible jitters. Warner's was jittery about this. And I heard from my sources that they set a very low budget. Obviously, Toby Emmerich, who runs Warner Brothers now, the film studio, wants to be friendly to Todd Phillips, the filmmaker who has brought them a lot of hits, like the Hangover franchise. Wants to be filmmaker friendly, but was, you know, nervous, maybe set of, I heard, a very low budget, hoping that they would kind of throw up their hands and say, well, we just can't do it for that number. But guess what? They didn't.
Yeah. Now they've got a hit on their hands and they're likely going to do an Oscar campaign for this movie. So, you know, it's telling to me that when the families of the Aurora shooting victims in 2012 in Colorado came out against the film, they didn't call for the film to not be released. They said, you know, we respect the studio's right to release the film. Instead, they asked for more advocacy on gun victim rights legislation and other things. And Warner's responded that they are active in that area. But I think that the interesting thing about that was they weren't coming out against the film per se. They were just using the film as a stepping stone to advocate against gun violence. And that's a key difference.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's hope that all the talk about it doesn't inspire anything and that it's just plays like a movie and that's it, as it should. Let me pivot. We talked a little bit last week about the Endeavor IPO, but that news was just breaking when we recorded. And now we've had a little bit of a chance for it to settle in. This is a big deal. I mean, Ari Emanuel has been one of the most brash, ambitious, the best known agent probably out there, right? And this is a setback. This is a thing where a lot of people were expecting to make a lot of money. They have a huge amount of debt. They spend a lot of money to diversify so they aren't only a talent agency. And now this public offering didn't happen. And, you know, they watched Peloton. We had a story that I did this past week about how they watched Peloton go public. And even before it was listed, it was clear it was going to be bad. And these guys had been on this crazy roadshow of visiting 65 cities and doing dozens and dozens and dozens of presentations for the previous 2 weeks. And then they just were at this moment where they were terrified that they would open at a lower number than they they wanted to, you know, price it at a lower number than they wanted to, and watch it drop. And their valuation would get pulverized. And so they made what had to be an enormously painful decision to pull the plug. And it's really, I think, shaken confidence within the agency, and I would say a Schadenfreude festival around town for people who were, you know, a bit tired of Ari Emanuel's swagger.
Oh, my text messages have been blowing up from random agents who are, you know, just saying, about time, you know, how did he get away with this for so long? This never made sense. You know, this is a disaster. How has WME not thrown Ari Emanuel out onto the street? I think that's a little overblown. You know, this is a very sophisticated executive, as well as one of the most brash and confident people in town. He will be back. I don't worry about the future of this company. I think they will find a way to raise the money they need to pay off debt, to make further acquisitions. Will they go public? I don't know. You know, they say this is only a delay, but this is a pretty big rejection of that strategy they had, which was to buy a lot of disparate assets in the generic entertainment, hospitality, sports, fashion, music space, and then put them all together and go public to raise a bunch of money and buy more stuff.
Yeah.
I don't see the market in the short term supporting that company.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people felt they overpaid. So they do have the debt. They gave up their Saudi money in the wake of the Khashoggi murder. And some people have said they're going to have to go back to the Saudis. I think if that becomes public, it creates a perception problem for them in the industry. You know, they say they're okay for now, but a lot of people think this is, they're going to have to do something. And, you know, they're going to have to buy some 400 of their employees have stock, and some of them were compensated with stock and told this pot of gold is visible at the end of the rainbow. Well, that pot of gold just kind of moved way down the road. So they do have some figuring out to do, and they may have to sell some assets. Who knows?
Yeah. And I think one of the first priorities is to make some of these key employees happy, because the big risk would be that people start leaving. And everybody around town is now saying, oh, you know, is so-and-so going to go to CIA? Is UTA going to try to break off the music group at WME or something like that, which would be a big disaster if they started hemorrhaging employees. And I think Ari and his team will at least try to make them somewhat whole and offer them the opportunity to cash in some shares in advance or in lieu of this IPO.
Yes, we know they're going to do that. The question is, will it be enough? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Our listeners know that we sat down recently with filmmaker Kevin Smith in his home studio to talk about his new movie, Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, and a lot of other stuff. The conversation went on for so long, we actually had to pause for a bathroom break, and that's a first for this show. Last week, we covered Smith's film, his relationship with Harvey Weinstein, and his Netflix anxiety. But I also wanted to talk to him about the late Stan Lee, his idol and friend. The comic book legend who first wrote many, many Marvel characters, including Spider-Man and the X-Men, died last November at 95. In 2018, just a couple of days after Smith suffered a near-fatal heart attack, he called me saying he was worried about Stan Lee. He insisted that I come to his house, though of course I was worried about what might be a very stressful conversation so soon after Smith almost left the planet. But Smith insisted. When I made my way to his house, I brought along my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Gary Baum. He had written about allegations of elder abuse following the death of Mickey Rooney, so I felt sure he was the right reporter for this job. Before we hear from Smith, we'll let Gary Baum tell what happened that night and after.
So we head over to his place in the Hollywood Hills, and it set me off on this journey that had to happen pretty quickly, because it seemed to be a situation where there were a lot of characters and a fragile dynamic at play.
Yes. His daughter was the person who had introduced a set of these alleged bad actors. And the daughter does appear to be a very difficult personality.
Yeah. The relationship with this daughter, J.C. Lee, is fundamental to the whole situation, both in the people that she brought into Stan Lee's life and his inability to keep them out once his wife, Joni, had died.
His wife of many, many years.
Of many, many years, who acted as a bulwark. She, by all accounts, was and is a fairly troubled person. She was very pushy toward him. So that dynamic was just the basis for everything else that flowed out.
JC then introduces another set of players.
Yes. One was a fellow named Jerry Olivares. Jerry was somebody who had started to become a bit of a, I'd say a gopher, a personal assistant for Stan. And particularly after Joni had passed away, he had quickly started to take over this kind of almost majordomo capacity. And then we get to this fellow named Kia Morgan.
Right. And it seems that with the advent of Kia in the picture, things ratchet up pretty dramatically in terms of who is controlling Stan Lee's life.
Correct. Kia gets very involved in Stan's finances, Stan's healthcare, and he really ends up taking control of power and edges out Jerry Olivares and creates an alliance with JC. And at the same time, they're replacing household staff and
changing phone numbers. People can't call Stan Lee.
They're isolating. And it's creating a lot of hubbub because Stan is somebody that is highly visible and highly accessible to a lot of people, and it sets people off. And a lot of people have a lot of questions about Kia, who kind of came out of nowhere for most people, and have a lot of concerns about JC, whether she was taking advantage of her father, whether she herself was being taken advantage of by these other people.
So you report, you get to talk to everybody in the drama. This is a story that ran in the Hollywood Reporter. And then I think Kia Morgan ends up getting arrested initially for like false police reports.
Yes, it's sort of a complicated situation what happened, but essentially he swatted the police. It's a very complicated, I don't want to misrepresent what happened.
We'll say allegedly.
Yeah, there's allegedly some things went down and he ended up in trouble. This happened a few months after my story came out, which was in April of 2018. This happened in, I think, June or July of 2018. And there was eventually a restraining order placed against him by Stan Lee's team, and he had to be separated. And then Stan Lee passed away that November.
And then it was a while, but there was more legal action involving Kia.
Right. So Stan Lee passed away nearly a year ago, and then the LA County District Attorney's Office started investigating him.
And him being Kia Morgan.
Kia Morgan. He was arrested on various charges, and he's currently still dealing with those charges.
Yeah.
J.C. Lee ended up with basically what she wanted, and she ended up with the estate, which she always was going to end up with anyway.
She also recently gave an interview, I think, to TMZ saying, when my father died, no one from Marvel or Disney reached out to me. From day one, they have commoditized my father's work and never shown him or his legacy any respect or decency. In the end, no one could have treated my father worse than Marvel and Disney's executive. Having been through the story and the reporting, I don't know if you feel like that's an accurate notion.
She holds a huge grudge about what she thinks Stan Lee should have gotten. She believes that her father made a lot of poor business deals, which is kind of, everyone thinks that.
But he was not a good businessman.
He was not a good businessman. Nevertheless, the understanding is that his estate was worth somewhere between like $50 and $70 million. She believes that he should have been worth, you know, $1 billion at his death, and that she's going to somehow find a way to claw it back, and that her birthright was squandered. And so she is very embittered by that.
And as you will hear from Kevin Smith, you know, nonetheless, Stan Lee, Kevin felt, was very, very attached to her, and that wresting him away from her circle was so painful.
I mean, that's what's interesting about this story, is that as famous and successful as he was, he had a problematic, challenging, inextricable relationship with this person that he loved, that as soon as his wife passed away, everything came apart.
A sad story. Not what fans of Stan Lee would want for somebody they love so much and admire so much.
Yeah.
Including Kevin Smith.
True.
Gary Baum is a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after a short break, Kevin Smith remembers his friend and mentor, Stan Lee, and the chaotic struggle of Lee's final year. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. This week, filmmaker Kevin Smith is telling us about his role in the attempted rescue of Stan Lee. In Smith's 1995 movie Mallrats, the heartbroken college student Brody, played by Jason Lee, is stunned to find himself getting relationship advice from one of his heroes, Marvel legend Stan Lee.
I can't believe I'm standing here talking to you. You're responsible for the greats. Let's do the list. Spider-Man.
Guilty.
The Incredible Hulk.
Afraid so.
Oh man, this is so cool. The X-Men.
Now that you mention it,
you are a god.
After Mallrats, Smith stayed in touch with Lee. When he told me in early 2018 that something bad seemed to be happening, of course I listened. I think the heart attack had you literally gotten out of the hospital not even 72 hours before you told me to come over to the house. I remember it because I was scared to come over.
Why were you scared?
I knew it was about Stan Lee, and I knew you were upset about it. Yeah. And I thought, is this a good, I think I even asked you, is it a good idea for me to come over? And I brought my colleague, Gary Baum, and talk to you about this very upsetting set of circumstances when you just got out of the free, you almost died. I'm fine. I'm fine. Come on over. It's fine.
It was important. I've never felt so like, I don't want this to sound the wrong way. I don't ever feel powerful. I'm not ever like, I'm in control of things. But I know where I came from and I know where I am today. And it might as well be the moonshot, the fact that I got here and stuff. So I am impressed with myself. You know, I don't think I'm smart. I don't think I'm talented, but I think I'm incredibly clever. And okay. I think clever goes a long way.
Clever goes a long way.
Absolutely. Because of that, you always think you can fix situations. And I don't do that. I don't meddle in people's lives and be like, oh, but if people come to me for help or whatever, or if you see somebody in need, you can do things. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes you just cut somebody a check, change their whole life, you know? But then there was a situation with Stan that was incredibly frustrating where I felt impotent and insanely powerless. And I turned to you.
To be clear, when you were watching people take advantage of it.
This is in the last year of his life when videos started popping up of him at cons, not looking like Stan, like the Stan I knew. And I couldn't get in touch with him because all the numbers that I had.
Yeah, they were changing numbers.
Changed and severed and stuff like that. It was frustrating watching him go down in real time because I know, like, you got to understand, when I first met him in 1995, they said, you be careful with this man. He's 72 years old. He could die at any minute. I was like, 24 years later, he was still kicking. That is a vital guy. And I honestly believe in my heart of hearts, he could have made it to 100 or further. Even with the passing of his dearly beloved wife, Joni.
Yes, that was a devastating thing.
Even with that, yeah. I believe he could have made it because I have to imagine, left alone, you have a less of a chance sticking around if you're just by yourself in an isolated bubble.
Sure.
Than if you're out there vitally around people who are appreciating you and you're going to work every day. That guy was still working up until...
Yeah, he was worshipped. Yes.
So even now I have a hard time talking about it because I understand like why I felt powerless or why I couldn't do anything because ultimately he didn't want something done because it was a family matter.
Right. He had a daughter who was, you know, she was what she was and he didn't want to go against her.
Yeah. I miss him. And it was the worst time of my life, not because I'd had a heart attack, but because here was a guy who wrote every story about some, you know, crazy in a colorful costume, saving somebody at the last minute and nobody could save him. And I used to think he had to be saved from someone, but ultimately I think we have to save him from himself. He won't do it. He can't because he's protecting the very person who's not protecting him. And so I reached out to you because I'm like, maybe a piece, you know, like some kind of expose, some kind, just anybody to like do something. Because I was like, even now it's hard because I'm like, I know he wouldn't want me to say something because it's a family matter.
Complicated, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying. And normally anybody listening who knows me is like, you won't shut up. You're incredibly eloquent. Why can't you spit this out? Because it still feels like a betrayal. I felt like I betrayed him when I even called you because I was just like, he wouldn't want this. But I'm like nobody will do anything. Nobody can do anything. It's not that nobody would do anything because there were other people as well. But nobody could do anything because they kept him so locked down and away from people. Did you see those videos? They looked like hostage videos. Stan Lee threatening to sue somebody in one of those videos going, Kia Morgan is my friend and anyone that says different, I'll sue you.
Kia Morgan being the sort of ringleader of what was going on with Stan at that point.
Like Stan never said things like that. I mean, yes, at one point he was in a lawsuit with Marvel. That was a business thing. But he was never out there in the world going, I'm going to sue your ass. Like that was just not even Stan. He was being puppeted. So the whole thing was really heartbreaking. And I reached out to Kim because I was like, you must be able to do something. You brought in the dude. Kim Gary, was real smart about it. Yeah.
Yes.
She was like, this guy wrote a piece about how Mickey Rooney was taken advantage of.
Exactly. I forgot you that I said that.
Changed
but I did.
The rules, changed the laws. And I said, all right, can you bring him over? And so we started the process of trying to do something. And it took a minute.
While.
Yeah.
Yeah. But ultimately there was an arrest and Stan was removed from that situation. So you weren't powerless. And
no, but we didn't.
I know you can't fix that though, can you?
He like that's the one I'll take with me to the grave. Cause like I liked him. Like, you know, he was an icon. And I met him in 95 on Mallrats. And it took me 10 years to figure out that he thought of me as a friend. I thought he was just always being nice or like a colleague, like, oh, it's Kevin, we made that movie. And it took me a decade to realize that, like, oh my God, we're actually friends. The guy who created all my favorite characters, like, likes me. And this is who Stan Lee was. On Mallrats, Jim Jacks. Remember the producer, Jim Jacks?
Very well.
Miss him. Jim Jacks was our producer. I turned in the draft of Mallrats. There's a scene in Mallrats that's got a guru, comic book guru in it. Jim Jacks goes, who's this meant to be? I said, like, Stan Lee. It would be like a Stan Lee. And he goes, why don't you just write it for Stan Lee? And I was like, I don't know Stan Lee. And Jim Jacks was like, I do. I go out to lunch with him or dinner every month at Dan Tana's. And I said, Hollywood is good, man. These know each other. So he said, write the scene with Stan, and then I'll bring it to him and see if he wants to do it. And so I rewrote it for Stan. I knew Stan's voice because I'd known him my whole life. He was the narrator of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and he also wrote in Stan's soapbox. And so I knew his voice. It was easy to write it to him. And he became my Wolfman Jack character in that scene. That's what Tom Pollock said. He goes, he's
Tom
like
Pollock
Wolfman.
Having been at the time the chairman of Universal Studios.
Universal.
Yeah.
He was like, that's like Wolfman Jack with Richard Dreyfuss in George's movie.
He that goes, would be American Graffiti.
And
just
Tom
for
Pollock
those who
goes,
are following along.
Tom Pollock goes, this movie's going to make $100 million. He was off by 98. But he loved that scene. He thought the Stan Lee scene was beautiful. So anyway, Jim brings that Stan Lee scene to Stan. They go to Dan Tana's. And then Jim calls me afterward and he goes, I just had dinner with Stan. I gave him the scene. I said, what did he say? And he goes, he wants to talk to you on the phone. I said, what? Stan Lee wants to talk to me? He said, yeah, he wants to ask you a question first. I said, but what did he say about doing it? And he goes, do you really want to know? I said, yeah. And then in his best Stan Lee voice, Jim Jacks goes, Stan said, I would never say this shit. And so I said, like, you told him it's a fake movie, right? He said, that's why he wants to talk to you. So I called Stan Lee, or he called me, but I'll never forget him going like, this is Stan Lee. And I said, I know exactly who you are. What an honor this is. Started listing the comic book conventions I saw him speak at and whatnot. And I said, I can't thank you enough for even talking to Jim about doing this. And he said, well, that's what I want to talk to you about. I would love to do this because I love acting. I'm a ham. And he was. He goes, but in this scene, you have me telling a character about the girl that got away and how it affected my life. And he's going, that's fine. And I could do that. But if I do that, the girl that didn't get away at home is not going to let me back into the house. So can we add a scene where I later on exposed that I was just kidding and that there is no girl that got away. And I was like, I'll do anything you want. Get you in the movie. It was like the sweetest, most touching thing I ever heard. Dude had been married to his wife at that point for the better part of 50 years. And we're doing a goofy teen movie that probably nobody was ever going to see. And still he had the concern enough for Joni to be like, I can't say that there was someone that got away because there was nobody but Joni. I interviewed Stan at his house, at him and Joni's house, like maybe a year or 2 years before he died for Legion M. They did this Stanley retrospective. It's not even out yet. They shot it in VR and it was meant to be a legacy interview because he was already old at that point. And so went through his house. You can, like, when it comes out, they said, you're going to be able to like put on the goggles, be right there with us and look around the room, stuff like that. So, you know, I'm doing the same standard interview with Stan that I'd always done, doing his entire history and stuff. We did it once on a DVD long ago. Then they bring up Joni. Joni is going to talk as well. And Joni, you know, always comes up and tells the Joni stories. One of which, of course, is like, she's the one that told Stan to write Fantastic Four. Stan wanted to quit Marvel and was like, I'm done with this. And she's like, well, before you leave, write what you want to write. Just write one for you. And it was Fantastic Four and it changed everything. So Joni comes up to do that interview. Sits down, says, hey, Joni, blah, 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 pleasantry and whatnot. I said, Joni, tell us again about how you told Stan to build the Marvel Universe by saying to write Fantastic Four. And she smiles, and then her smile goes away, and her lip quivers, and she starts tearing up. And I look to Stan, and Stan is off camera. Like, so he's in my eyeline, but he's not on camera, and he's looking right at Joni. And Stan's smiling, because I think he knows what's about to happen. And then all of a sudden, Joni just bursts out, man, because she had a British accent. So it sounded so classy. She goes, it's always Spider-Man, Spider-Man, Spider-Man. Nobody knows that the man is a poet. He's written me the most beautiful letters, and all they talk about are his heroes. And Stan is sitting right behind her, beaming with love, like, he met many fans. There was the only one that mattered. So when I saw that, it hurt even more because it's just like, I get what people are trying to do. They're trying to isolate this man and take away his money. They were trying to rob an old man, one of the most famous old men on the planet. And they got away with it for a long, long time. It just hurts. And you know, again, makes me mad. And I'm glad something happened, but
you couldn't bring her back, but you could get him away from that situation, in which you did do.
I'm telling you, man, he could have stuck around for longer. Like, he was vital. Even though he was old, he was incredibly vital. He loved life. Even, you have to remember, we did the handprint ceremony with Stan at the Chinese 4 days after Joni died. Five, maybe. Like, it was scheduled, and then Joni passed away, and we all assumed, like, there's no way we're going through with this. And he did. He strapped on that Stan Lee sweater and went and played Stan Lee one more time for everybody, even though his heart was breaking.
That was filmmaker Kevin Smith. You can hear more of our conversation with him on last week's show, his new movie, Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, which naturally makes mention of Smith's own comic book characters, Bluntman and Chronic, is in theaters October 15th. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and Drake Warna. You can subscribe to The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.